Possession number 16585, Karen Churchill, reel 5.
Karen Churchill, reel 5. Going back into the war period, did you hear anything of the July plot against Hitler?
Yes, yes. Yes, we heard again as a child that there was an attempt made, and Hitler again miraculously escaped. And of course I say how I remember, you see, how it is being portrayed. He is destined to lead the German folk to victory, and therefore he is destined to be saved, and a plot has been hatched, a wicked plot has been hatched to try to assassinate him. So all this what I sort of remember, the propaganda, and he miraculously escaped. And that was when we had one of those rallies on the Elbe, these how he miraculously escaped, and sort of he has sort of built up the aura of the invincible savior. That was after that July plot. So I say to you, from a child's memory, this sort of thing. That's all. The history can be, you can read the names up in the history and all that. Quite frankly, but that's what I remember. The Elbe, the banks of the Elbe, they're wide meadows, and of course we all assembled there, and there were masses of people there, and these loudspeakers, they always had these rallies, you see. God, da, 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 fanfares and all this business, you know. Gosh, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be so comical, you see.
Little brother, how was he coping through this
period?
Well,
he just kept with me, so we tied ourselves together more or less.
And his sight, that did recover in one eye, did it?
Yes, but it recovered in one eye about a year after, I would say. So he stayed quite dependent.
Yeah. Of course, you know, at that time, and you've explained this, there was very little welfare provided.
Yes.
You wouldn't have had anything like counselling then.
Oh, and well, that is a myth, quite frankly. The only counsel that is your own substance.
Do you believe that?
Yes. Your own substance, it is the shock, your own substance, and the belief in God. It keeps you upright. Anything else is just dilly-dallying. You need somehow, when people go through terrible things, I find people cope with a lot of things. People have resilience in them, which they don't know they have. But what knocks the bottom from under their feet is when other people belittle their suffering. That is a danger. That is where real illness steps in. That's my personal feeling. Because when I think, my goodness me, you look all over the world, they have no counselors. It is a sense of stepping into, again I come back to this, into a different dimension, away from focusing on little details. Little details are the frills that are, you can home into it when your fundament is in order. This well, I somehow feel of, but in comparison, when a certain group of people is being slotted into another group of people, and it, the differences are neither recognized nor acknowledged, then friction occurs, and that can lead to suffering, more suffering in fact than the original suffering. That is all taken in its course somehow. But the way I said about this wretched little Professor Pomeran there.
Who was he?
A professor of modern history in the University of Dresden, who came and gave a lecture on the true facts behind the bombing of Dresden, who then belittles the experiences of real survivors as a propaganda being used by neo-Nazis. I think that is shocking. And the anger it engenders is, one has to be very careful not to let it eat into one. But people like that, in a seat of learning, influencing young minds, are in an important position, and it's again dangerous to have people like that in a position of influence.
Did you object to that when he spoke?
Yes, I objected to that, because he for some reason, for some strange reason, he tried to doctor facts.
And that's interesting, because he was doctoring the facts from what you're saying.
Yes,
about the German guilt.
He was doctoring the facts of the number of casualties in Dresden. We have been, we always knew until this professor put it down, or some newspaper brought down this mystical figure of 35,000. We always knew it was about 650,000 or 600,000 thereabout. Well, seeing the sea of bodies, it couldn't have been any otherwise. And then the ones you can't even identify. How can you count? In fact, in this book here, it says, which one? There, here, where? Here. Body count in Dresden under the supervision of Russian officers. But how could an accurate figure be arrived at when thousands of bodies were reduced to nothing but fine dust? By the firestorms. There.
So what did he say to your arguments against him, this professor?
He said that these figures were being used by neo-Nazis, and my memories were that rather hysteric of a child, distorted memories of a hysteric child. And I very much objected to that, because it's unworthy of a professor of modern history. That I objected to.
Could I now ask you about your experience under the occupying Russians? Yes. How did things become? Did things become more sort of organized and safer for you with time?
Yes. Then the Russian occupation, they were setting up a commandantur, that is the commander of this occupied area, was setting up, and then people had to register. And my father, as a so-called intelligentsia, had to register, and he was entitled to a slightly higher food ration, again, men who use their brain. And it slightly went back to a more normal time. And in fact, we didn't experience any harassment from them. That was good. What we experienced, just the storm troops, if I put it this way, were these fighter troops who had to make their spearheads through in their own way, if I may put it this way. But that didn't happen anymore.
Were you aware that the occupying power was communist? You know, did this come into it?
Yes. Of course, it was communist, and which of course is the ideology of Russia, their political system. But it didn't really affect us as such. It didn't really affect us as such. My father started to be try to bring some cultural life going again. He founded the Kulturbund, Cultural Bund, and that was when we had sort of poetry evenings and concerts and, gosh, sitting there, trying to dress ourselves and having no shirt and just a piece of white paper and had you clip there and paint some buttons on to put it underneath your jacket, sit there, but pad it out with newspaper because it's so blooming cold and this sort of things. And sitting in that concert hall, they're listening there, how these violinists, their fingers are freezing on all this. And oh dear, I remember these things. But to the very first things of people doing things again, which are feeding the mind, and gradually, and of course the Russian, they had their they were very keen singers and dancers, and I grew up then. I was 17, then I went to the Academy of Art then, and there we had a choir and I sang there, and we also went singing to the comic opera in Berlin. We had our trips there and we sang Russian ballads and things, learned these things there as well. So we gradually established a more modern life. But it is extremely stifling for a man who is more used to more intellectual life.
What was happening regarding your housing? You know, you were saying how you were living in these little huts.
Yes.
As time went on, you know, after the war, were you rehoused?
No. We were in this little place. And then from there we fled. What prompted us to go make our way to Munich was, as my brother was prisoner of war, captured by the Americans, and was in a prisoner of war camp outside Munich. And so we thought we'd make our way there.
Before you go to Munich, did you not spend some time in Leipzig?
Yes, in the Academy of Art.
Yes, could you tell me about that? Because I know you've got a very interesting story about the statues on the...
Interesting.
Oh, was it?
That was
interesting. Could you tell me about that work?
Well, what it was, in fact, in Leipzig, I went to the Academy of Art there. And, of course, as a sculpture student, we were bused to Dresden and taking part on the restoration work of the Zwinger. So we were then given the task of doing restoration work on those figures. Of course, the original Pöppelmann figures were saved, and we had to recreate copies because the copies of these Pöppelmann figures had been destroyed in the raid. So we had to recreate new copies to put back onto the restoration of the Zwinger. And as sculpture students, we all had to do our effort in the restoration of. But again, in order to go study, I had a grant. I had a grant, and which I'm very surprised, sort of probably, and we had to also work certain hours in cleaning rubble. That means all the bricks and all the rubble and the bomb rubble. We had to clean the bricks and stock up the bricks again for reuse. And that we had to do so and so many hours of that before we were entitled to move on into the next term. So if you want studio, don't whinge, go to the council, make your own. This sort of thing. And if you haven't got any tools, look, if you find a bit of iron, make your own tools.
What was morale like then, you know, in the Dresden area?
This is sort of it. How shall I put this? Morale. One thing was a relief. You got away from that freaking Hitler. That was that continually that earwig in your ear. That was a relief. I mean, we felt like that. Whether the others, I don't know. But then it became more normal. I know the Russians, they were occupying and set their rules, and everything went into the communistic sort of ideology. And well, so far it didn't hurt us. We got on with our studies, and more or less we. Of course, the black market was, if I may say so. I was in order to get a little bit more funding, so I was cutting hair for the students. Then out of old car tires, I was soling the shoes for the other students. So cutting the soles and soling shoes, and making dolls or whatever, exchanging them again for bread or what. So little things like that. But we felt there was a kind of camaraderie of all the people who tried to do their best under difficult circumstances. I mean, here was the same. I mean, this seems to be an indomitable human spirit which transcends all borders, if I might put it this way. But we didn't really, apart from finding the ever nagging hunger a bit hard to bear, one day I said, oh, I wish for Christmas one big King Edward potato. Wonderful. For Christmas, you know, boiled potato, wonderful. The smell of it, warm. The aroma of a boiled potato. Things like that. Oh dear. But so.
But your decision to move, does this imply that you were aware of sort of politics, that Germany was becoming divided?
Yes. Oh yes. Oh yes. Oh yes. Also, my father found it very difficult to continually have to fit into a communistic ideology. And we decided to just up. And well, before we went, I mentioned before about these educational sheets my father and I we were making, and I've got it somewhere here. Got it to hand now. This, what it was, an ethnographical little collection for children at school to cut out these ethnographical and ethnological figures to build up their little museum or collection, whatever. And so we were going from school to school to hold these talks, my father on his crutches, no car, loading everything up into a little hand cart which I pulled, and my brother held on the other hand of the handle. He couldn't see, I mean, what a trio. And we went there to hold these talks. And now, And we found then at that time we heard from where my brother was, and my father thought, well, it's time to leave. So we were still living in this little hut there, and we thought we make our way to Hof. You know, I still have my old Russian passport and all the old Russian passport and my entrance where my father and us we all went together. We took the train, and then two stations before the border we got out and walked that way, trying to get across the border. And there is a piece of no man's land you have to cross before you can get into the western sector. And of course my father got through. He said, I go first, and the best protection for you is if you do not know, literally do not know which way I go, in case we get caught and they needle you until you say. And he went his way, we went our way, we walked. We thought, my brother and I thought, well, I can't clamber with my brother through with one eye. We walked along the road. I thought, we had a cape, and that cape looks in the dark like these Russian capes. And along the road there were these Russian sentry hats, those hats, and then also holes in which soldiers were sitting and observing. And we walked past these blooming holes, and thank God they were drunk. They didn't see anything, but we got caught, I'm afraid. We got caught. So my brother and I, we got caught. We were children, so that probably might make it a bit easier. Well, young then, you see. I was 50 when we tried to get across. So I was about 19. So. And brought back to Leipzig, needled and questioned, because my father then was an ethnologist, one of the intelligentsia, this sort of thing. Where is he? We couldn't tell you. We can't tell you. Where is he? We can't tell you. Well, in the end, then they had to let us go because we couldn't tell him. And that was the best thing our father could have said. You see? And then a year later, we tried again. Got out again.
The same place?
Yes.
And that place was Hof, was it?
Hof, yes.
So what happened that time? Could you tell me?
Yes.
How did you prepare? You know,
got over.
It?
Well, just wore our clothes. You know. Well, the very first time when we all went, we just left this little hut, and left as if we had just popped to a neighbor, the bed just made, but one corner opened as if you just want to go in, the supper table laid. You know, this sort of family life, not sort of tidied up and gone. But unfortunately, this escape was unsuccessful. You see, but the next time, my brother and I, we were in Leipzig. I went to the Academy of Art and he went to the Conservatoire, the music school. And so we both were living in the deserted Japanese embassy, and well, of course the Japanese went, you see, but the embassy was, well, that building was still there, and the old lady who looked after that, and I was there. They had students in, and so we stayed there. So from there we tried to make our second escape, and I got through. My brother got shot at.
How can you? Could you tell me about your own escape?
Mine. By Hof again. And got through, and on the other side.
You just walked through, did you?
Yes.
Were you not seen by the sentries?
No, it was in the dark. Yes.
Did you creep?
Yes, crept through. So that was, you see, that was still not the Iron Curtain as such. It was still a wire there, no man's land in between. You see, so it wasn't quite like that then, like the Iron Curtain. And went to Leipzig, went to Munich.
You were saying your brother was shot at?
Yes.
What happened to him?
Well, he was shot in the leg and he limped along there and he came across and he got bandaged and looked at. So he came through too. So we were then finally in Munich. But in Munich itself had some bomb damage as well. So Munich, when you know in Munich the Königsplatz, and along the Königsplatz, the Glyptothek, Pinakothek, when you know these great big austere buildings, the previous Hitler buildings there was one that wasn't quite finished. And in the cellar of that one, we found an overhanging slab, which was a sort of unfinished stairs, which we then, from bricks which we cleaned from bomb rubble, built a wall up and had that as a little room where we lived in. Yeah, I have a photo of that one. And that was our home until then. My father got rehoused later in Munich. But a long, long time we lived like that. And that is why I get so angry when people whinge when they haven't got the latest, best news and all that and can't even throw a button on.
Yes, how did you cope with money, you know? Because the currency would have been different, would it not?
Well, we had none. We never had any. This is my father then became a small, he got a small pension that was in West Germany, of course in East Germany, that he was gone and that finished. He just said he was a refugee and he had a small pension given. And then of course he started to hold lectures again, and so we gradually got a bit of money there. And I went to the Academy of Art and I got a grant again there in Munich. And my twin brother, he carried on at the conservatoire in the music school, so he had a grant. And then we were working in the holiday times. I was in Siemens and Agfa developing films and doing this. And I was then renting small rooms according to my budget, which I had. None of that going to the counter, give me a room and pay for it. And no, you had to stretch yourself according to your blanket. You see?
Was and the Berlin blockade a factor in you leaving? Did it mean anything to you at the time? That would have been before you left, wouldn't it? 1948.
The blockade and the rescue flights of the airlift. It didn't really affect us as such, but it might have motivated my father. But we were wrapped up in our own studies and in Leipzig, and coming back to Leipzig there. We were before we went to the Japanese embassy there. We went to a small that was a diaconissen, that is sort of Protestant sisters, nuns. They had a home for elderly people, and they took us in as well. And when we went back with that Bach tour, before the war came down. I was looking for that house and I found it again, completely unchanged. So I was very pleased.